As we kick off the new year, many of us resolve to grow closer to God. But how do we actually do that? Well, we have a resource to help you do just that through our free ebook, 5 Ways to Connect with God. This resource shares 5 simple but powerful spiritual practices to deepen your relationship with God, from cultivating thankfulness to asking God for a word for the year. This guide will help you to find rest, focus, and renewed connection with God as we begin the new year. Download your copy now at premierinsight.org. Start your year off closer to God. That's premierinsight.org. Now, let's get started with today's episode.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
First things first, Happy New Year. In this special episode, you're going to hear some clips from a programme called Free Thinking, which was originally broadcast on the BBC. Last December, I was invited to take part in an episode which focused on C.S. Lewis and his impact today. The other guests on the show were Meg Thompson, the producer of Freud's Last Session, a film starring Anthony Hopkins as Sigmund Freud and Matthew Goode as C.S. Lewis, Jem Bloomfield, an assistant professor at the University of Nottingham and author of Paths in the Snow, and Justin Briley, author of The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, and obviously an old friend of ours here at Premier Unbelievable. The Freethinking episode was presented by Dr. Chris Harding, a cultural historian of Japan, India and East-West connections based at the University of Edinburgh. And it was produced by BBC producer Ruth Watts. Do make sure that you check out the whole Freethinking episode on Narnia and C.S. Lewis, as I've only included a few short clips here. I'll make sure that there's a link to the full programme in today's show notes. Freethinking goes out on BBC Radio 4 on Friday nights at 9 p.m. and you can also listen online or on podcast via BBC Sounds. This first clip that you're about to hear is about the film Freud's Last Session, and presenter Chris Harding is speaking to the film's producer, Meg Thompson.
Meg, Freud's Last Session is set in London in September 1939. Where is Freud in his career by this point?
At that point in his career, Freud is at the very end of his life. He was to die 3 weeks later on September 23rd, 1939. I mean, what the film envisions is that because he's at the end of his life, he wants to see if he missed something. And so he turns to C.S. Lewis to say, "Did you see something I missed?" Again, we don't know if they ever met. The professor, Armin Nicolai, guessed that they might have, or liked to suppose that they did, because their ideas are so sort of pitted against each other in such a way, so strongly. It was taught at a course at Harvard for 35 years by a professor named Armin Nicolai, just basically talking about Freud and Lewis's ideas, which then became a play, Freud's Last Session, which then has now become the movie. And the movie is set up almost as a dream, almost as a therapy session, where basically Freud is the psychoanalyst and C.S. Lewis is telling about the details of his life. September 3rd, 1939 was chosen because that is the day that Britain enters the war. And so they're on the precipice of war, as it often feels like we are now. So it feels very relevant to today. And at that point, C.S. Lewis had only published one work of fiction, Pilgrim's Progress, and that had been inspired by his talks with Tolkien and with Dyson on the famous Addison's Walk, where they discussed Christianity. And he then wrote Pilgrim's Progress as a sort of update of John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress. So if Freud had been alive and was reading his fiction, that would have been the one book that Freud would have had access to in 1939 before his death.
Mm. I love the idea of Freud being worried at the end of his life, is there something I missed? It's amazing to think as well that it's been roughly, 30 years since Anthony Hopkins actually played C.S. Lewis in the film Shadowlands, about an older Lewis facing challenges to his faith. It's probably fair to say in those 30 years, UK's become a more secular culture. So there's quite an important role for dramatic sympathy in trying to get across a sense of the urgency of this encounter, isn't there, between Lewis and Freud. How does the film try to create that atmosphere?
I mean, because it's all set on one day, there's an urgency to what they're discussing. And with war looming over them, with their ideas so strongly pitted. And I mean, I think what's really important to know about the film is that it's a conversation, and it's about knowing that somebody else on the other side might have a completely different idea to you, but yet you can hear them and you can argue your point and you don't necessarily have to win. And that's sort of the way it's presented as a conversation or a debate, which I think right now, you know, the world is so divided, and I think that it's very much encouraging of listen to the people who have different ideas from you and what they have to say.
That was Meg Thompson and Chris Harding on the programme Free Thinking, which was originally broadcast on the BBC. Much more was said by all of us about the connection between Freud and Lewis, so do check out the full episode of Free Thinking. You can also hear more about the film Freud's Last Session on this podcast. In episode 163 of the C.S. Lewis podcast, I spoke to Hollywood director Matthew Brown, who directed and co-wrote the film starring Anthony Hopkins and Matthew Goode. I'll make sure I include a link in the show notes. In the clip that you're about to hear, free thinking presenter Chris Harding asks Justin Briley about materialism.
Justin, Meg was mentioning C.S. Lewis's book there, Pilgrim's Regress. It uses characters like the wonderfully named Sigismund Enlightenment to have a go, perhaps not always very subtly, at Marxist and Freudian variations on this idea of materialism, the idea that physical matter in motion is all there is to reality. Do you think that materialist conviction or assumption is still one of the things that advocates for Christianity now feel that they need to tackle?
I think it has been very much high on the agenda because the New Atheism, a very strong movement that sort of really gained a head of steam in the mid-2000s, has kind of been the bete noire of many Christian philosophers and theologians, because led by, you know, high-ranking scientists like Richard Dawkins and polemical journalists like Christopher Hitchens, they very much stood in an anti-God, anti-religious frame of mind. And yes, if they had a creed, it was materialist scientism, if you like. And to that extent, they said, well, we need to obviously get rid of all this fairy tales and delusion and replace it with reason, science. And for whatever reason, they assumed that that meant we do live in a purely material universe where everything, I suppose, all our ideas, thoughts, consciousness is purely a result of those material factors. And to that extent, they are very much the inheritors of Freud and Marx, who approached life as materialists and saying everything can ultimately be explained by these things. Lewis, of course, stood against that, having once believed it himself. You know, that's the fascinating thing about Lewis, is he went on his journey from materialist atheist to theism and then eventually Christianity. And I'm interested in the fact that you do see these cycles in time. So 100 years nearly since Lewis had his conversion, you're seeing, I think, again, a kind of turning against that scientific materialism in our culture, even though it was very popular only 20 years ago. And I'm fascinated by the fact I'm now seeing public intellectuals seeming to go on a very similar journey to Lewis, starting to reconsider whether actually there might be more to life, there might be more in the universe than just atoms and electrons.
Mm. Ruth, I can see you nodding away there. What's your experience?
Well,
with this?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think they would have articulated it in a similar way that Lewis would have done. And also Freud, that kind of longing, that sense of, he termed it joy, but he didn't necessarily mean joy in the way that we would mean it now. That just that longing and the fact that actually he didn't really find that until he became a Christian, and that's where he found all of his joy and all of his pleasure. And it's joy in the sense that it's so much more complete than what he thought he was looking for until he found it. And I think you do see those parallelisms where up until his conversion, he was very much a proponent of Freud and would have adhered to a lot of the things that Freud did. And you see it in all of his fiction as well. He's, you know, I don't know whether we're going to talk about the science fiction, but he sort of raises there that the materialist, you know, it's almost like a negative apologetic. Imagine this world without God and see where it leads you. And actually, if you abolish God, then perhaps you eventually, the logical conclusion is to abolish humanity. But then it sort of works itself out as actually, what if we do put God back into the picture? What does that look like? And it's a kind of, he still holds on to rationality and reason. And in some ways, the things that that he held as an atheist. He doesn't pit faith against reason, which I think a lot of the new atheists perhaps do. And there's lots of lines in Mere Christianity to show that actually he doesn't believe that faith and reason are antithetical. I think at one point he says that faith isn't the opposite of reason. Faith is holding onto something that your reason once believed, but your emotions are now telling you is not true. So I think that's quite an interesting thing. He didn't throw out any of his intellectualism or his rationality, but he sort of moved on and saw that actually the arguments were in the favour. And he called himself one of the most reluctant converts in all of England. And I think it's almost like he didn't want Christianity to be true. But, you know, what he saw as a rationalist, the arguments were in its favour. And it was almost against his better wishes that he became a Christian, because he couldn't help but see that it was true.
That was Justin Briley and I chatting about the New Atheist Movement on the BBC's Free Thinking programme. We've obviously covered this topic many times on numerous Premier Unbelievable shows, but I would particularly recommend some of the programmes that we made around the book Coming to Faith Through Dawkins, which was co-edited by Professor Alistair McGrath. I'll make sure that there's links to these shows below.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
I don't know about you, but sometimes I have big questions about life and I want thoughtful answers. That's why we're excited that we have this resource to offer called Ask NT Wright Anything, 12 Crucial Questions About Faith, the Bible and Life. This ebook distills wisdom from one of the world's leading theologians, N.T. Wright, tackling topics like life after death, the reliability of scripture, predestination, and more. It's our hope that this resource will strengthen your faith and deepen your understanding. And here's the best part. It's our thank you gift when you give to support Premier Insight this month. So don't miss this opportunity to grow in your faith. Visit premierinsight.org to give today. That's premierinsight.org. Thank you for your generosity. And now, let's get back to today's episode.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. In this final clip, Freethinking's Chris Harding speaks to Jem Bloomfield, Assistant Professor of Literature, about Mr. Tumnus.
Now, at one point in the film, Freud's Last Session, Freud asks Lewis, was it your parents who injected you with the fairy tale of faith? A common atheist refrain, and yet for Lewis, fairy tales and myths were by no means just made-up stories. They played a role in his conversion to Christianity, as we've heard, and as an apologist, Lewis came to realise, as his biographer Alistair McGrath has put it, that the imagination is the gatekeeper of the human soul. Jem, perhaps for some of us it's been a while. Could you perhaps sketch the basics for us?
Oh, certainly. So it begins, as Meg mentioned, during the Second World War. A group of children are evacuated to a mysterious country house in the middle of the English countryside. The youngest child discovers, as they explore the house, a wardrobe through which she can pass to a different magical land. She meets a faun. She discovers that said magical land is under the rule of some sort of icy witch queen who is evil and who keeps it always winter and never Christmas. She gets out of the wardrobe again. Her siblings at first don't believe her, but then one of them, Edmund, finds his way in, meets the queen, is tempted by Turkish delight, one of the great symbols of the novel. And you can't have a conversation about C.S. Lewis for long with anyone without them going, what about Turkish delight, man? Is it actually any good? Anyway, he is persuaded by the joy of this Turkish delight to betray his siblings because the witch is worried about a prophecy that four children will come from another world and will destroy her reign. There are some talking beavers again, that's a longer story. And this world is eventually saved by the arrival of Aslan, a lion who acts as a sort of messiah figure, who rescues Edmund, who has fallen into the witch's clutches, by being sacrificed on a stone table that looks oddly like Stonehenge, and then coming back from the dead and routing the witch's armies.
You've hinted at it there with the mention of Stonehenge. Lewis tested that theory about the imagination in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. It's a story that many of us, of course, will know. But one of the things your book does, this is Paths in the Snow, a literary journey through The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, is make connections both with this broad literary history that we're all heirs to, but also what's going on at the time when Lewis is writing. So to give us an example of what you're doing, perhaps tell us a little bit about Mr. Tumnus, the Faun. What sorts of connections have you traced?
Yes, he's a fascinating character, and one which fan culture has picked up. In a lecture I give to my university students, I have several slides on what I refer to as the Tumnus thing. He's obviously immensely attractive to people in a range of sometimes troubling ways. But he's a Faun, and this little child, Lucy, meets him as soon as she gets into Narnia. And he seems to me to be an echo of a figure that appears in a lot of literature at the time, that of Pan. The pagan god from Greek mythology, who was a relatively minor god in Greek mythology, but he becomes immensely important in the imagination and the literature of Western Europe in the sort of late 18th and 19th centuries. He appears in all sorts of magazine stories and poems. He appears in sculpture. There's a couple of short stories by Saki, Hector Hugh Monroe, the 19th century satirist. And in fact, there's a whole chapter in The Wind and the Willows, which not everyone knows about because it's sometimes edited out of modern printings, especially in America, where Mole and Ratty are looking for a lost child and they encounter Pan. And there's this extraordinary rhapsodic description for pages and pages, very affecting, of their sense of awe and their sense of trembling and wonder. That's very, very different from the dashing about in motor cars and dressing up as laundresses and that a lot of the rest of the book involves. And they encounter this genuinely mystical figure at the centre of the book. So I think what Lewis is doing is drawing on this presence of Pan in both sort of adult fiction and children's fiction, and presenting him as exciting and attractive, but a gateway to another world. I'm really interested in the way that Tumnus is at the door of the wardrobe in Lantern Waste. In The Wind of the Willows, he's at the centre of the novel. He's the secret in the middle of the woodland, in the middle of the river. Whereas for Lewis, I think, who feels hugely the attraction of pagan myth, he absolutely loves it. It's one of the things that clearly enlivens his imagination. But for him, unlike for so many intellectuals of the time, paganism is not the deep secret upon which later classical and Christian culture is built. Christianity is the great secret. The Logos, the person of Christ, is the great presence at the beginning of the world. And then paganism gives us hints or glints or enchantments or pointings towards that. In writing a novel for children in which there are lots of characters like ice witches and Father Christmas and pagan fauns and things, and which, as many people know, Tolkien was appalled by, the sheer eclecticism of this novel. To my mind, he's inverting one of the great arguments against Christianity at the time. So works like J.G. Fraser's The Golden Bough in the 19th century set out to show that Christianity is just another myth, essentially, that we can find dying and rising gods all over human culture, the cult of Attis and Osiris, that a Christ who is killed and goes down into the earth and stays in the earth for a symbolic amount of time and then rises again is just a fertility god. That's just another corn god. We've got loads of those all over the world. And this is a very common objection to Christianity in this period. The uniqueness of the Christian myth seems to have been worn away by it. And Lewis believed this for quite some time, and then came to believe that the inverse is true, that in fact these are all shards and glints and pointers, because this is the structure of reality, the dying and rising god, but not all cultures have seen it precisely revealed in the same way that it was revealed in the person of Jesus Christ.
That was Jen Bloomfield and Chris Harding on the programme Free Thinking, which was originally broadcast on the BBC. We chatted at greater length about Narnia and Lewis's fiction more generally, so do check out the full episode of Free Thinking. You can also hear more from Jem and his book Paths in the Snow in two recent episodes that I recorded with him for the C.S. Lewis podcast. Jem spoke to me about biblical imagery, story, and Christmas, among many other things, on episodes 187 and 188. A quick reminder that Free Thinking goes out on BBC Radio 4 on Friday nights at 9 p.m, and you can also listen online or on podcast via BBC Sounds. A big thank you to the guests on today's show: Meg Thompson, the producer of the film Freud's Last Session, Jem Bloomfield, author of Paths in the Snow, and Justin Briley, author of The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. Thank you too to Dr. Chris Harding, who presented this episode of Free Thinking, and to BBC producer Ruth Watts. As I've said, I'll include a link to the full episode in the show notes. From me and all the team at Premier Unbelievable, Happy New Year. Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This just in, hot off the bench press. Planet Fitness has added new strength equipment. Save $28 or more when you join today, and you can be one of the first to try it out. We're raising the bar with new benches, and our new hack squat will have you actually looking forward to leg day. Plus, we're still repping all of the best-in-class equipment we've always had, with most clubs open 24 hours, so you can work out your way on your time. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 10th. See Home Club for details.